trying to school you. Listen to me, people. Do you understand? We gotta
stand up.
Oh, you've been sitting way too long.
Come on, step up.
You know what's right and you know what's wrong.
Rise up.
Don't let the system hold you down.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. The Ralph Nader Hour with Ralph Nader came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Think about becoming a WBAI buddy. You can go to the website, give2WBAI.org. Sign up, and each month a certain amount is taken out of your account, and that will be a cushion that BAI can rely on a monthly basis and plan accordingly. So go to our website, give2WBAI.org. Coming up is Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 7 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
Tell me a story about your time at WBAI so I can let people know that you, in fact, have returned from retirement.
I retired because I was tired, but I found retirement more tiring than coming to BAI. BAI can be exhausting. Trump's there, and you have to yak about it. And if you're sitting at home, you're just shouting to the walls. When you have a program at WBAI, you can alert them about Donald Trump.
That's David Rothenberg. Tune in to any Saturday mornings from 8 to 10.
This is a well-oiled promotion, please.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Good morning, and good Samhain. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Today is October 30th, and so we will, of course, acknowledge All Hallows' Eve with what I believe to be the best horror short story ever written. First, a little bit of music and some words from Dan Persons, and then, well, stay tuned.
forbid, ye maidens all, that wear gold in your hair, to travel down to Carterhaugh, for young Tamlin is there. Then let go by Carterhaugh, but they leave him a pledge, either their mantles of green, or else their maidenhead. Janet tied her kirtle green a bit above her knee, and she's gone straight without command from me. I'll come and go, young Janet said, and ask no leave of thee. Then I've spoken. Janet, he said, I think you go with child. Well, if that be so, Janet said, myself shall bear the blame. There's not a knight in all your halls shall get the baby's name. Oh, tell to me, she heard the bridle ring.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. Jean-Luc Godard once said, "Film is truth 24 times a second," which is a lovely poetic statement and nowhere near correct. And in fact, the full quote is, "Film is truth 24 times a second, and every cut is a lie," which is getting closer to the point. There is power in cinema. It is, in my humble opinion, the most powerful of art forms, but the final effect depends on who's wielding that power and to what end. In Labyrinth of Cinema, the last film of Japanese maverick director Nobuhiko Obayashi, which opened at the Metrograph on the 20th and is hopefully still playing there by the time this review runs, three young moviegoers commemorate the closing of their local cinema by attending an all-night movie festival and are so entranced by the show that they are actually swept up onto the screen and into the stories. This is not a new trope. Among others, anime director Satoshi Kon used something like it in his not dissimilar Millennium Actress. The difference here is that the festival these spectators/protagonists are attending is a screening of Japanese war films, so their journeys within the cinematic world take them from patriotism-rousing historic epics to dark glimpses into Japan's invasion of China to vignettes of a nation struggling with the sobering reality of being on the losing side of a conflict to the apocalyptic culmination of Hiroshima. I haven't seen any of Obayashi's other works, but I'm going to have to track them down. To say he has an unusual approach to storytelling is to put it mildly. He begins the film with what I presume is the director's surrogate, named the maybe-punning Fanta G, landing in a spaceship in Obayashi's hometown to attend the closing night film festival. He doesn't rely on any actual footage from war-era movies, but instead insinuates his moviegoers into his own recreations. Whether these are based on actual films or are Obayashi's own fancies, I don't know. And the cutting is frenetic to the point where Michael Bay would get dizzy. But where Bay's editing is purely for adrenaline's sake, Obayashi appears to be working toward a kind of cognitive dissonance. Your eyes tell you you're looking at a light-hearted, fast-paced montage of soldiers training. Your brain realizes that what these men are training for is a suicide mission from which there will be no return. It's easy enough for filmmakers to celebrate the romance of their art, the whole Cinema Paradiso thing, which I do not at all object to. In Labyrinth of Cinema, Obayashi, as his final offering, does wish to pay homage to his art, but also to warn us not to get too far swept up in its seductions. Filmgoing is regarded as a passive activity, but the truth, 24 frames a second or not, is that we should not relinquish full agency to its influences. Labyrinth of Cinema may be a love letter to the movies, but one that is well aware of its paramour's foibles. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Boys and girls of every age, wouldn't you like to see something strange?
Come with us and you will see, this our town of Halloween.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween.
Ground sharp and the eyes glowing red.
I am the one hiding under your stairs. Fingers like snakes and spiders in my hair.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everybody's waiting for the next surprise.
Round that corner and hiding in the trash can.
Bloody green.
Aren't you scared?
Well, that's just fine.
Say it once, say it twice. Take a chance and roll the dice.
Right,
shadow on the moon at night, filling your dreams to the brim with fright.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween,
Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Jingle-a-lings everywhere, life's no fun without a good scare.
That's our job,
but we're not mean
in our town of Halloween.
In this town,
we love it now.
Everyone's waiting for the next surprise.
Skeleton Jack might catch you in the back and
scream like a banshee, make you jump out of your skin.
This is Halloween, everybody scream.
Won't you please make way for a very special guy?
Wildman Jack is king of the pumpkin patch. Everyone hail to the pumpkin king.
Now this is Halloween, this is Halloween. Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
Thank you, Dan. This week we will celebrate the most famous of the pagan or neo-pagan holidays, Samhain, better known as All Hallows' Eve, or if you prefer, Halloween. Samhain, which is spelled S-A-M-H-A-I-N, has over the years changed its interpretation in many ways. Its origins, of course, lie in paganism, generally in a more positive light than we currently give it credit for. But in more recent years, it has become associated purely with horror stories. Now, I'm no fan of body horror and things like that, but I do like a good chill, and I love a good ghost story. Many great writers, from Charles Dickens to Oscar Wilde, have had their say, but I believe what we are about to hear may be the finest horror story ever written, even if it is not a ghost story. No, it's not Hour of the Wolf by Ingmar Bergman, although that sounds like a good movie from which to title a radio show, but rather, this is The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. We are fortunate enough to have a copy of Ms. Jackson reading her story in the Pacifica Archives, and we will present that forthwith.
The morning of June 27th was clear and sunny, with the fresh warmth of a full summer day. The flowers were blossoming profusely, and the grass was richly green. The people of the village began to gather in the square between the post office and the bank around 10 o'clock. In some towns there were so many people that the lottery took 2 days and had to be started on June 26th. But in this village, where there were only about 300 people, the whole lottery took less than 2 hours. So it could begin at 10 o'clock in the morning and still be through in time to allow the villagers to get home for noon dinner. The children assembled first, of course. School was recently over for the summer, and the feeling of liberty sat uneasily on most of them. Soon the women standing by their husbands began to call to their children, and the children came reluctantly, having to be called 4 or 5 times. Bobby Martin ducked under his mother's grasping hand and ran, laughing, back to the pile of stones. His father spoke up sharply, and Bobby came quickly and took his place between his father and his oldest brother. The lottery was conducted, as were the square dances, the teenage club, the Halloween program, by Mr. Summers, who had time and energy to devote to civic activities. He was a round-faced, jovial man, and he ran the coal business, and people were sorry for him because he had no children and his wife was a scold. When he arrived in the square carrying the black wooden box, there was a murmur of conversation among the villagers. And he waved and called, "Little late today, folks." The postmaster, Mr. Graves, followed him, carrying a 3-legged stool, and the stool was put in the center of the square, and Mr. Summers set the black box down on it. The villagers kept their distance, leaving a space between themselves and the stool. And when Mr. Summers said, "Some of you fellows want to give me a hand?" There was a hesitation before two men, Mr. Martin and his oldest son Baxter, came forward to hold the box steady on the stool while Mr. Summers stirred up the papers inside it. The original paraphernalia for the lottery had been lost long ago, and the black box now resting on the stool had been put into use even before Old Man Warner, the oldest man in town, was born. Mr. Summers spoke frequently to the villagers about making a new box, but no one liked to upset even as much tradition as was represented by the black box. There was a story that the present box had been made with some pieces of the box that had preceded it, the one that had been constructed when the first people settled down to make a village here. Every year after the lottery, Mr. Summers began talking again about a new box, but every year the subject was allowed to fade off without anything being done. The black box grew shabbier each year. By now it was no longer completely black, but splintered badly along one side to show the original wood color, and in some places faded or stained. Mr. Martin and his oldest son Baxter held the black box securely on the stool until Mr. Summers had stirred the papers thoroughly with his hand. Because so much of the ritual had been forgotten or discarded, Mr. Summers had been successful in having slips of paper substituted for the chips of wood that had been used for generations. Chips of wood, Mr. Summers had argued, had been all very well when the village was small. But now that the population was more than 300, and likely to keep on growing, it was necessary to use something that would fit more easily into the black box. The night before the lottery, Mr. Summers and Mr. Graves made up the slips of paper and put them in the box, and it was then taken to the safe of Mr. Summers' coal company and locked up until Mr. Summers was ready to take it to the square next morning. The rest of the year the box was put away, sometimes one place, sometimes another. It had spent 1 year in Mr. Graves' barn and another year underfoot in the post office, and sometimes it was set on a shelf in the Martin grocery and left there. There was a great deal of fussing to be done before Mr. Summers declared the lottery open. There were the lists to make up of heads of families, heads of households in each family, members of each household in each family. There was the proper swearing-in of Mr. Summers by the postmaster as the official of the lottery. At one time, some people remembered, there had been a recital of some sort performed by the official of the lottery, a perfunctory tuneless chant that had been rattled off duly each year. Some people believed that the official of the lottery used to stand just so when he said or sang it. Others believed that he was supposed to walk among the people. But years and years ago this part of the ritual had been allowed to lapse. There had been also a ritual salute which the official of the lottery had had to use in addressing each person who came up to draw from the box. But this also had changed with time, until now it was felt necessary only for the official to speak to each person approaching. Mr. Summers was very good at all this, in his clean white shirt and blue jeans, with one hand resting carelessly on the black box. He seemed very proper and important as he talked interminably to Mr. Graves and the Martins. Just as Mr. Summers finally left off talking and turned to the assembled villagers, Mrs. Hutchinson came hurriedly along the path to the square, her sweater thrown over her shoulders, and slid into place at the back of the crowd. "Clean forgot what day it was," she said to Mrs. Delacroix, who stood next to her, and they both laughed softly. "Thought my old man was out back stacking wood," Mrs. Hutchinson went on. "And then I looked out of the window and the kids was gone, and then I remembered it was the 27th and come a-running." She dried her hands on her apron, and Mrs. Delacroix said, "You're in time, though. They're still talking away up there." Mrs. Hutchinson craned her neck to see through the crowd and found her husband and children standing near the front. She tapped Mrs. Delacroix on the arm as a farewell and began to make her way through the crowd. The people separated good-humoredly to let her through. Two or three people said, in voices just loud enough to be heard across the crowd, "Here comes your Mrs. Hutchinson." And, "Bill, she made it after all." Mrs. Hutchinson reached her husband, and Mr. Summers, who had been waiting, said cheerfully, "Thought we were going to have to get on without you, Tessie." Mrs. Hutchinson said, grinning, "Wouldn't have me leave my dishes in the sink now, would you, Joe?" And soft laughter ran through the crowd as the people stirred back into position after Mrs. Hutchinson's arrival. "Well, now," Mr. Summers said soberly, "guess we better get started, get this over with, so's we can go back to work. Anybody ain't here?" "Dunbar," several people said. "Dunbar, Dunbar." Mr. Summers consulted his list. "Clyde Dunbar," he said. "That's right, he's broke his leg, hasn't he? Who's drawing for him?" "Me, I guess," a woman said, and Mr. Summers turned to look at her. "Wife draws for her husband," Mr. Summers said. "Don't you have a grown boy to do it for you, Janie?" Although Mr. Summers and everyone else in the village knew the answer perfectly well, it was the business of the official of the lottery to ask such questions formally. Mr. Summers waited with an expression of polite interest while Mrs. Dunbar answered. "Horace is not but 16 yet," Mrs. Dunbar said. "Guess I gotta fill in for the old man this year." "Right," Mr. Summers said. He made a note on the list he was holding. Then he asked, "Watson boy drawing this year?" A tall boy in the crowd raised his hand. "Here," he said. "I'm drawing for my mother and me." He blinked his eyes nervously and ducked his head as several voices in the crowd said things like, "Good fella, Jack. I'm glad to see your mother's got a man to do it." "Well," Mr. Summers said, "guess that's everyone. Old man Warner make it?" "Here," a voice said, and Mr. Summers nodded. A sudden hush fell on the crowd as Mr. Summers cleared his throat and looked at the list. "Already?" he called. "Now I'll read the names, heads of families first. And the men come up and take a paper out of the box. Keep the paper folded in your hand without looking at it until everyone has had a turn. Everything clear?" The people had done it so many times that they only half listened to the directions. Most of them were quiet, wetting their lips, not looking around. Then Mr. Summers raised one hand high and said, "Adams." A man disengaged himself from the crowd and came forward. "Hi, Steve," Mr. Summers said, and Mr. Adams said, "Hi, Joe." They grinned at one another humorlessly and nervously. Then Mr. Adams reached into the black box and took out a folded paper. He held it firmly by one corner as he turned and went hastily back to his place in the crowd, where he stood a little apart from his family, not looking down at his hand. "Allen," Mr. Summers said. "Anderson." "Bentham." "Seems like there's no time at all between lotteries anymore," Mrs. Delacroix said to Mrs. Graves in the back room. "Seems like we got through with the last one only last week." "Time sure goes fast," Mrs. Graves said. "Clark? Delacroix?" "There goes my old man," Mrs. Delacroix said. She held her breath while her husband went forward. "Dunbar," Mr. Summers said, and Mrs. Dunbar went steadily to the box, while one of the women said, "Go on, Janie," and another said, "There she goes." "We are next," Mrs. Graves said. She watched while Mr. Graves came around from the side of the box, greeted Mr. Summers gravely, and selected a slip of paper from the box. By now, all through the crowd, there were men holding the small folded papers in their large hands, turning them over and over nervously. Mrs. Dunbar and her two sons stood together, Mrs. Dunbar holding the slip of paper. Harbert? Hutchinson? Get up there, Bill, Mrs. Hutchinson said, and the people near her laughed. Jones? They do say, Mr. Adams said to old man Warner, who stood next to him, that over in the North Village they're talking of giving up the lottery. Old man Warner snorted. Pack of crazy fools, he said. Listening to the young folks, nothing's good enough for them. Next thing you know, they'll be wanting to go back to living in caves. Nobody work anymore, live that way for a while. Used to be a saying about lottery in June, corn be heavy soon. First thing you know, we'd all be eating stewed chickweed and acorns. There's always been a lottery, he added petulantly. Bad enough to see young Joe Summers up there joking with everybody. Some places have already quit lotteries, Mrs. Adams said. Nothing but trouble in that, old man Warner said stoutly. Pack of young fools. Martin? And Bobby Martin watched his father go forward. Overdyke? Percy? I wish they'd hurry, Mrs. Dunbar said to her older son. I wish they'd hurry. They're almost through, her son said. You get ready to run tell Dad, Mrs. Dunbar said. Mr. Summers called his own name and then stepped forward precisely and selected a slip from the box. Then he called, Warner? 77th year I've been in the lottery, old man Warner said as he went through the crowd. 77th time. Watson? The tall boy came awkwardly through the crowd. Someone said, Don't be nervous, Jack. And Mr. Summers said, Take your time, son. Zanini? After that, there was a long pause, a breathless pause, until Mr. Summers, holding his slip of paper in the air, said, All right, fellows. For a minute, no one moved, and then all the slips of paper were opened. Suddenly, all the women began to speak at once, saying, Who is it? Who's got it? Is it the Dunbars? Is it the Watsons? Then the voices began to say, It's Hutchinson, it's Bill. Bill Hutchinson's got it. Go tell your father, Mrs. Dunbar said to her older son. People began to look around to see the Hutchinsons. Bill Hutchinson was standing quiet, staring down at the paper in his hand. Suddenly Tessie Hutchinson shouted to Mr. Summers, You didn't give him time enough to take any paper he wanted. I saw you. It wasn't fair. Be a good sport, Tessie, Mrs. Delacroix called. And Mrs. Graves said, All of us took the same chance. Shut up, Tessie, Bill Hutchinson said. Well, everyone, Mr. Summers said, that was done pretty fast, and now we've got to be hurrying a little more to get done in time. He consulted his next list. Bill, he said, You draw for the Hutchinson family. You got any other households in the Hutchinsons? There's Don and Eva, Mrs. Hutchinson yelled. Make them take their chance. Daughters draw with their husbands' families, Tessie, Mr. Summers said gently. You know that as well as anyone else. It wasn't fair, Tessie said. I guess not, Joe, Bill Hutchinson said regretfully. My daughter draws with her husband's family, that's only fair. And I've got no other family except the kids. Then, as far as drawing for families is concerned, it's you, Mr. Summers said in explanation. And as far as drawing for households is concerned, that's you too, right? Right, Bill Hutchinson said.
How many kids, Bill? Mr. Summers asked formally. Three, Bill Hutchinson said. There's Bill Jr., and Nancy, and little Dave, and Tessie and me. All right, then, Mr. Summers said. Harry, you got their tickets back? Mr. Graves nodded and held up the slips of paper. Put them in the box, then, Mr. Summers directed. Take Bill's and put that in. I think we ought to start over, Mrs. Hutchinson said as quietly as she could. I tell you, it wasn't fair. You didn't give him time enough to choose. Everybody saw that. Mr. Graves had selected the five slips and put them in the box, and he dropped all the papers but those onto the ground, where the breeze caught them and lifted them off. Listen, everybody, Mrs. Hutchinson was saying to the people around her. Ready, Bill? Mr. Summers asked, and Bill Hutchinson, with one quick glance around at his wife and children, nodded. Remember, Mr. Summers said, take the slips and keep them folded until each person has taken one. Harry, you help little Dave. Mr. Graves took the hand of the little boy, who came willingly with him up to the box. Take a paper out of the box, Davy, Mr. Summers said. Davy put his hand into the box and laughed. Take just one paper, Mr. Summers said. Harry, you hold it for him. Mr. Graves took the child's hand and removed the folded paper from the tight fist and held it, while little Dave stood next to him and looked up at him wonderingly. Nancy next, Mr. Summers said. Nancy was 12, and her school friends breathed heavily as she went forward, switching her skirt, and took a slip daintily from the box. Bill Jr., Mr. Summers said, and Billy, his face red and his feet overlarge, nearly knocked the box over as he got a paper out. Tessie, Mr. Summers said. She hesitated for a minute, looking around defiantly, and then set her lips and went up to the box. She snatched a paper out and held it behind her. Bill, Mr. Summers said, and Bill Hutchinson reached into the box and felt around, bringing his hand out at last with the slip of paper in it. The crowd was quiet. A girl whispered, I hope it's not Nancy. And the sound of the whisper reached the edges of the crowd. It's not the way it used to be, old man Warner said clearly. People ain't the way they used to be. All right, Mr. Summers said. Open the papers. Harry, you open little Dave's. Mr. Graves opened the slip of paper, and there was a general sigh through the crowd as he held it up, and everyone could see that it was blank. Nancy and Bill Jr. opened theirs at the same time, and both beamed and laughed, turning around to the crowd and holding their slips of paper above their heads. Tessie, Mr. Summers said. There was a pause, and then Mr. Summers looked at Bill Hutchinson, and Bill unfolded his paper and showed it. It was blank. It's Tessie, Mr. Summers said, and his voice was hushed. Show us her paper, Bill. Bill Hutchinson went over to his wife and forced the slip of paper out of her hand. It had a black spot on it, the black spot Mr. Summers had made the night before with the heavy pencil in the coal company office. Bill Hutchinson held it up, and there was a stir in the crowd. All right, folks, Mr. Summers said. Let's finish quickly. Although the villagers had forgotten the ritual and lost the original black box, they still remembered to use stones. The pile of stones the boys had made earlier was ready. There were stones on the ground with the blowing scraps of paper that had come out of the box. Mrs. Delacroix selected a stone so large she had to pick it up with both hands, and turned to Mrs. Dunbar. "Come on," she said, "hurry up." Mrs. Dunbar had small stones in both hands, and she said, gasping for breath, "I can't run at all. You'll have to go ahead and I'll catch up with you." The children had stones already, and someone gave little Davy Hutchinson a few pebbles. Tessie Hutchinson was in the center of a cleared space by now, and she held her hands out desperately as the villagers moved in on her. "It isn't fair," she said. A stone hit her on the side of the head. Old Man Warner was saying, "Come on, come on, everyone." Steve Adams was in the front of the crowd of villagers with Mrs. Graves beside him. "It isn't fair, it isn't right," Mrs. Hutchinson screamed, and then they were upon her.
You have been listening to Shirley Jackson reading her classic horror story, The Lottery, originally published in 1948. It is a work in which the greatest horror is probably the phrase, "It isn't fair." And I believe that's just what got under people's skin. It is such a subversive work that it caused a good many subscribers to cancel their subscriptions to The New Yorker. Now we're hoping for the opposite. Maybe this broadcast may entice you to become a subscriber to listener-sponsored WBAI by calling 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Or visit give2wbai.org. That's the number 2, give2wbai.org online, and pledge your support. By the way, if you want to see one of the best ghost stories made on film, it too is based on Shirley Jackson. Look for The Haunting, directed by Robert Wise. Accept no substitutes.
She showed me a shirt of the softest silk, well wrought with pearls about the band, saying, "If you will be my lover so true, this goodly gift you shall command." Alison Gross, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country. Alison Gross, she must be the ugliest witch.
Majesty, show me a cup of the good red gold, well set with jewels of fantasy. Says if you will be my lover so true, this goodly gift I would give to thee. Away, away, you ugly witch, go far away and let me be. I never would kiss your ugly mouth for all of the gifts that you could give. Madison Rose, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country. Madison Rose, she must be the ugliest witch in the North Country. She's turned her body to round about, and thrice she blew on a grass green horn. She swore by the moon and the stars up above that she'd make me rue the day I was born. Then out she has taken a silver wand, she's turned her three times round and round. She's muttered such words till my strength it did fail, and she's turned me into an ugly worm.
Thank you. the middle of the night, she heard the bridle ring. She heeded what he did say, and young Tam Lin did win. Then up spoke the fairy queen, an angry queen was she. Woe betide her ill-fared face, an ill death may she die.
You've been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next Saturday morning at 7 a.m. Do not forget to support WBAI by making a pledge at 212-209-2950 or visiting us online at WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. If you enjoyed the program you just listened to, think about becoming a WBAI buddy. Sign up, have a certain amount taken out of your account on a monthly basis, $5, $10, $15, $20, $25, whatever you can do. That will be a cushion that BAI can rely on a monthly basis and plan accordingly. You go to give2wbai.org and become a WBAI buddy. So do it now. Go to give2wbai.org. But whatever you do, do something. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
I believe that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Hard work is how we support ourselves and our families. The jobs we do are a big part of who we are, and our jobs keep America going, yet the job site is where we have the least power. Many of us voiceless as corporations gamble away our health and our family's future just to feed their greed. It's time for the working class majority, for you and me, to regain our voices, to turn up the volume, assert our collective power, and to organize. Join me, Rick Smith, every Saturday night from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York as we bring the class war and fight for a better future. The Rick Smith Show, every Saturday night, 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York's listener-supported radio. For more information, visit WBAI.org.
You have only my word before God that what follows is pure and simple fact.
That's one of the classic horror stories coming to life on WBAI Playhouse Saturday evening at 8 o'clock.
The blood is the life. The blood is the life. The blood is the life.
That's Bram Stoker's Dracula, with David Selby as the vampire hunter Van Helsing, John Glover as Renfield, that symbol of both good and evil, and Simon Templeman as Count Dracula.
Tell me, what is it? What are they saying?
Urdog means Satan. They wish to protect you from the evil one.
The evil one?
Vorlock means vampire.
That's Saturday, right before Halloween, right here on WBAI New York.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Frank
Hemp
with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
Extinction Diaries. A new study is raising an alarming question. Can marine plankton, the literal foundation of marine ecosystems and the producers of about half of our oxygen, survive the rapid warming our planet is proving to be experiencing? According to the study published in the journal Nature Communications, the cold plankton-rich southern oceans are the highest risk region for plankton extinctions. Scientists discovered that several million years ago, during the Neogene period that had similar warming as we see today, there was massive die-offs of microscopic plankton called radiolarians. The study contradicts previous assumptions that plankton will migrate to more favorable climate conditions as temperatures rise. Today, there are about 100 radiolarian species alive, and this study puts at least some, maybe most, of their survival in question. The result would cause cascading die-offs of species higher up the food chain. The entire scenario reveals just how little humans can depend on what we think we know about extinction, and how little an effort we have made to stop it. My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved, and the moral is...
You gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song. Oh boy, you're singing now, even when things go wrong. Oh Jimmy, you're a wow. You feel better, you know. I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Durante and David together again. I'm the David of the pair. That was Jimmy Durante. He's our theme song opener. For those of you who have just discovered this program for the first time, I'm on every Saturday, which is the name of the program, any Saturday on WBAI. Beautiful. I took my morning walk. The rain had stopped. The air is calm, slight breeze, almost tropical. It's Halloween weekend, which means that I'll lock myself in for much of the weekend. Amateur night in New York. Same New Year's Eve, St. Patrick's Day, Halloween. I leave it to the kids coming in from Westchester and Long Island and New Jersey. Although I don't know what the pandemic is doing to all of that this weekend. Talking about the pandemic, which I do with frequency. In the past week, I spoke with three people not getting vaccinated. Calm, quiet, reasonable, intelligent discussions. One with a listener, two with people I know who have revealed to me that they have not and do not intend to get vaccinated. There was no screaming. I listened carefully. None of the three seem to be conspiracy theorists. They just don't think that the vaccine... The similar trend was that they're not comfortable that the vaccine has been sufficiently tried, I guess. So it came too quickly. I tried to explain that the scientific community had been working on it way before COVID, that they knew there were things like this. But it was respectful. I told them I was concerned for their health and the health of the larger community. I talked about responsibility to the community. All three seem to be sufficiently masked and being respectful of other people. So it gets even more complex. That's very different than the assault of emails that I get. And the people that were marching, NYPD inspired march. But there was an interesting memo sent by a BAI producer named Amy Wilson, in which she pointed out that BAI people who are against the vaccine should be very careful in lining up with some of those who are organizing. What is it that she writes? And she talked about the NYPD union, which endorsed Trump in the last election and have repeatedly lied about NYPD's repressive tactics against protesters in the Black Lives Movement. But that's one aspect in how you view the police and one perspective. She then writes, it may be less known, but these marches are also attended by far-right groups who are currently using the terrain of anti-vaccine activity to organize and develop connections that strengthen them. Yesterday's march was attended by the Trumpist groups, Long Island Loud Majority and the New York Republican Club, both of which have demonstrable first-degree links to local Proud Boys, the men's only street gang dedicated to preserving Western values. Proud Boys marched openly in yesterday's event. These far-right organizing events must be opposed and their terrain must be limited in order to prevent further explosions of violence, which occurred on January 6th. That's all from Amy Wilson. It's very interesting that that is the part of the anti-vax movement, which is very political. And it's interesting that they're all acolytes of Donnie, who got the vaccination, but has been very careful and not advocating for his worshipers to proceed. one of the more hopeful notes is that the both police and fire department in the last 2 days have increased by several hundred people who have gotten vaccinated. I think a few might be waiting, maybe weighing Florida Governor DeSantis' offer to NYPD people that he'll give them $5,000 if they want to relocate down there. They don't have to be wet masks. They don't have to get vaccinated. And they can add to the statistics, which is that COVID is the largest single cause of death among police officers in America in the last year. And I think some 75 in New York have died of COVID cops. And it goes on. The correction officer are now about 80% vaccinated, up quite a bit. The lowest group is Department of Correction. They're still at 50%, but moving up. And there are also groups of under Progressive Commissioner Vinnie Schiraldi, there are groups of cadets training, correction officers in training, and they're ready to step in, or they will be ready to step in if some of these men and women opt to not show up. They haven't been showing up in great numbers. That's been one of the great problems out at Rikers Island. They've been staying away, calling in sick. Who knows what the ailment is? So their replacements will, their absenteeism or their leaving because they're not vaccinated won't be as dramatically felt as with the fire department and the police department because they haven't been coming in anyway. Isn't that interesting? Well, I tell you, you'll decide if it's interesting. I find it interesting. I also find it interesting that we get you to the theater. And I want to, we only have tickets for a few performances this week. We've been offering Paul Osborne's Tony Award winning Mornings at 7. After the first grumpy dissent from listeners, the emails have been pouring in. My favorite is the listener who said she wanted to take the whole cast home and stay with them. Beware of falling in love with the characters that actors play. I always remember when I was working with Betty Davis back in the day, and she had divorced Gary Merrill. They had met, or at least their affair began, when she was Margot Channing in All About Eve, and he was Bill Sampson. He was the director of The Star, Margot Channing, which Betty Davis played. And they had a big romance on screen and off screen. And Betty, at interviews and to me, said, I'll try and do my Betty Davis. The trouble was that I fell in love with Bill Sampson and he fell in love with Margot Channing. And when we got home, it was Gary Merrill and Betty Davis. The marriage didn't work. The relationship in the movie did. So when people say they loved Mornings at 7 and wanted to take the cast home, that's not who you'll be taking home. I can't wait to see it. I've been holding up for them to get, you know, a couple of weeks of rehearsals of previews in. And for you, the listeners, we have tickets Monday and Wednesday night at 7 and Wednesday matinee at 2, a $50 gift to WBAI. Stunning cast. Patty McCormick, who was our guest 2 weeks ago, Lindsay Krause, Judith Ivey, John Rubenstein, Tony Roberts, and everybody seems to know Dan Luria. I knew him from playing Vince Lombardi on Broadway, the football coach, but people say, oh, that's the guy from Wonder Years. Go no frame of reference, right? So it's it was a stunning play production when I saw it back in the 80s, and I gather from the warm response that I've gotten for the 30 or 40 people who have emailed who have seen it through our fundraising efforts, that it holds up. And I will be going this week. I'm juggling schedules, so I'm not sure which day. I got to get, hope I can reach someone over the weekend. So if you want to see Mornings at 7, Monday night at 7 and Wednesday night at 7 and Wednesday matinee at 2, email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give your phone number. And it would make it a lot easier for me if you give your address when you do email me. But the phone number is essential, and your name. A lot of people email me and don't give their name or their phone number, and then they're not going to get a call back. But mornings at 7, a treat, I gather. I'm waiting to be among the cognoscenti.